Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, in his book, At the Dawn of Tourism in Florida, John T. Foster argues that abolitionists, including Harriet Beecher Stowe, helped to start our tourism industry.
So she's a part of a group, but this group is related to each other, and they are motivated by being social activists.
Walt Disney was not the first major cartoonist to set up shop in the Sunshine State.
Walt Disney's strongest competitors, Max and David Fleischer, moved their very successful cartoon studios from New York City to Miami.
And we'll hear the late Florida historian Michael Gannon talk about Ponce de Leon. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
It's a world of laughter, a world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all. It's a small world after all. It's a small world after all.
Today, Disney World is nearly synonymous with Florida tourism, but the industry began a century before Walt Disney came here. In his latest book, At the Dawn of Tourism in Florida, Abolitionists, Print Media, and Images for Early Vacationers, John T. Foster Jr. makes a compelling argument that the birth of tourism in Florida did not begin with the railroad barons of the 1880s, as is popularly believed, but with social activist writers of the Reconstruction era following the Civil War. One of those writers was Harriet Beecher Stowe. Her abolitionist views led Stowe to write one of the most famous novels of her time, Uncle Tom's Cabin. John Foster.
It was the most popular novel written in the United States in the 19th century. The first year it was published in this country, it sold 350,000 copies. Estimated sales in the 19th century were 3 million in this country, 3.5 million abroad. And so it was incredibly popular in Great Britain.
When President Lincoln met Harriet Beecher Stowe, he only half-jokingly credited her with starting the American Civil War.
He greeted her at the White House and said, "So you are this little woman who started this great war." This is because a lot of people in the North had no real knowledge of slavery. And Uncle Tom's Cabin portrays slavery in all kinds of different ways. Southerners are portrayed at times very positively. This is not all a negative rant. Uncle Tom has become something of a synonym for a pleasant, meek, mild person of color. What people don't realize is that two women, two slaves, wanted to escape from Simon Legree, and Tom knew where they hid. And Legree and a bunch of his friends and colleagues went out into the swamps on two occasions trying to find these women. And after this, Legree confronts Tom and says, "You know where they are?" And Tom says, "Sure, I know where they are." And he says, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" And Tom says, "I can die." And so that's what uncorks Legree's rage. And he proceeds to beat Tom fiercely. He has some other slaves join him, and that, of course, destroys. But not before Uncle Tom looks at the blacks who participated in this and says, "I forgive you." And so they, in fact, convert to Christianity.
While living in Florida, Stowe wrote dozens of articles describing the state's wonderful weather, flora, and fauna. As John Foster points out in his latest book, At the Dawn of Tourism in Florida, and his previous book, Calling Yankees to Florida, Stowe's writings about Florida had an ulterior motive. She wanted to bring progressive northerners to the southernmost state.
She was trying to create a place of freedom in the South. This made sense because the Civil War had freed 4.5 million African Americans, and there needed to be a place for them to live. But it couldn't be based on an old economy driven by cotton. And so she's very much interested in tourism, of novel agricultural crops, citrus being a primary one. And in the wake of her activities here, citrus took off, and by the end of the 70s was a major source of revenue for farmers in Florida. And so she wants a different economy. And keep in mind, Florida in 1870 did not have 200,000 residents. You hear what I said? 200,000. It was actually like 180,000. And it was almost evenly half black and half white. I think there was 5,000 more whites. But the white groups are not exactly cordial with one another. You have the Minorcans from St. Augustine, who are here from the British colonial period, obviously Catholic, and have remained so. You have a large group of people who are rural frontier farmers, and these people are Protestant, but not really in churches. They're out in small farms. The Yearling is a portrayal of some of these people. Then you have a planter group, very much like you would have had in Virginia or in the Tidewater area, or in South Carolina in the Tidewater and Sea Islands. And these people are primarily 50 miles east and west of Tallahassee, where there are red clay hills. And so these two groups actually did not get along well, and the Civil War made it worse.
Foster says that Harriet Beecher Stowe and other writers are not given the credit they are due for starting Florida's tourism industry. Progressive Northerners were lured to the state with colorful descriptions of desirable weather and abundant natural beauty. Foster says that it was with these forward-thinking writers that modern Florida was born.
Attention from her has drifted off to other people, and some of it has been completely unwarranted. Historians of the last 20 or 30 years have given lots of credit to the railroad builders of the 1880s. And there's no doubt that they built fancy hotels and built railroads to new places in Florida. They did not bring the tourists. There are accounts, even in the New York Times, of 50,000 tourists being in Florida in 1873. This is a state that may not have had 200,000 residents, 50,000 tourists. And so she's contributing this, but people she knew were contributing to this as well. One of them was William Cullen Bryant, and William Cullen Bryant was a visitor to Mandarin. In fact, how I made some important discoveries is he's the one guest she mentions. And so I looked him up, and lo and behold, I ran into a tour book that featured Florida, a two-volume set. And I think each volume has, I want to say, 30 different chapters. Would you believe the rivers, St. John's and Ocklawaha, in this two-volume set is the second chapter. St. Augustine is in volume one as well as the 13th chapter. These are highly illustrated. So you've got William Cullen Bryant, people knowledgeable of 19th century poetry would realize that he was one of the greatest poets of that period. George William Curtis also featured Florida. In that era, Harper's was like, for people of a certain age, Life and Look magazine pulled together into one. Harper's, highly illustrated, every article. Illustration and a description of something and another illustration. Another. That's the way this is, except it's all lithographs, drawings by artists. And Curtis is with Harper's New Monthly. And Harper's is fantastically popular in the Civil War period and for the next most of the rest of the century. Harper's featured Florida 10 times in the 1870s. I don't know what other state was even a distant second. If you wanted to know what St. Augustine looked like, you could go to Harper's and see it. If you wanted to know what it looked like, you could go to that tour book that William Cullen Bryant's Association. You can see the fort in St. Augustine. You can see the lighthouse. You can even see the original lighthouse. And Florida's archives does not have an image of the 18th century archives. There is a lithograph of it, complete, made so that it looks like a fortress, is what you would want to be and have if you're out there on an island and pirates are available, English raiders are available. So she's a part of a group, but this group is related to each other, and they are motivated by being social activists.
Harriet Beecher Stowe was an active force in the effort to end slavery, using both her fiction and nonfiction writing as tools in that fight.
This can be traced back to the 1850s, and what had happened were all kinds of events that occurred in the wake of the Mexican-American War. The issue was, if you look at a space from Texas to California, up California to Washington, back to Minnesota, and down the western side of Iowa and Missouri, is a vast amount of territory. And the issue became in the 1850s, what is going to happen to all of this? How many states are there going to be? And so in doing this, she and others are afraid that slavery will expand into these areas. And with the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854, the issue is going to be put to a vote in Kansas Territory, slave or free. And there were people who decided to encourage settlers from the North to settle in Kansas.
Abolitionists in Kansas faced an uphill battle. Legislation was passed making it illegal to speak against slavery, and there was violence aimed at stopping abolitionists. The Immigrant Aid Company was formed to encourage progressive Northerners to move to Kansas, and by the time the Civil War started, the state supported the Union. Leaders of this successful abolitionist movement in Kansas would later turn their attention to Florida. John Foster.
So if you want to link them together, William Cullen Bryant was one of the directors of the Immigrant Aid Company in the 50s. Calvin Stowe, Harriet's husband, was a stockholder in the company, attended meetings, and he wasn't one who just was always silent either. He, in fact, is recorded in making statements and proposals. Curtis went to great length to say that the fate of this country was at stake. He did this in public, in a publication, comparing this situation in Kansas to Thermopylae in ancient Greece, and saying that the future is here. We've got to make a choice. So you have Curtis involved with abolition, and then you have Curtis at Harper's, featuring Florida. You have Bryant, who came to Florida in the 1840s, and so he already knew what Florida was like. He'd even published descriptions of Florida. So he knew that, in fact, these plans were plausible. So there's a consistency. Kansas and these activists are involved in it. The activists are supporting the federal government, and then they're supporting getting people to come to Florida.
John T. Foster, Jr. is author of the book At the Dawn of Tourism in Florida, Abolitionists, Print Media, and Images for Early Vacationers, and co-editor of the book Calling Yankees to Florida, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Forgotten Tourist Articles. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org, where you can now register for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Tallahassee Historical Society Bicentennial Conference, being held May 16th through 18th. Each morning at the Four Points Hotel, you can attend fascinating presentations and panel discussions, including a talk from John Foster, who you just heard discussing the dawn of tourism in Florida. Each afternoon, we'll tour historic sites, museums, and archives, including the Historic State Capitol Museum, Goodwood Museum and Gardens, Mission San Luis, and more. You can enjoy the annual Florida Historical Society Awards Luncheon and our banquet dinner with keynote speaker Mary E. Adkins discussing Florida constitutional law. Find out more at myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, many people associate the arrival of Disney in the 1970s with the birth of modern Florida. Whatever the validity of that interpretation, Walt Disney was not the first major cartoonist to locate in the Sunshine State, right?
No, he wasn't. Florida emerged as a tempting location for the film industry very early in its history. As David Morton and others have noted, Jacksonville attracted film companies in the 1910s in what proved to be a short-lived hope or promise as a competitor to Hollywood. In 1938, Florida once again engaged in the fantasy of becoming a film center when Walt Disney's strongest competitors, Max and David Fleischer, moved their very successful cartoon studios from New York City to Miami. Like so many others, their Florida dream did not end with a happy ever after. Donna Dial, an English teacher at the Dade Academy of the Teaching Arts, traced the rise and fall of Fleischer Studios in her article, Cartoons in Paradise, which was published in the winter 2000 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. As she notes, the brothers fought Hollywood, Disney, labor unions, and each other in the rough-and-tumble world of early film. Rising to the top with cartoon characters like Coco the Clown and his canine sidekick Bimbo, Betty Boop, and Popeye, Fleischer Studios succeeded spectacularly in the early days of film cartooning, but fell by the wayside as a result of poor production choices, familial and labor conflicts, and Disney's multiple innovations to the industry, including the introduction of feature-length cartoons.
And probably many people today have no knowledge of Max and Dave Fleischer and their pioneering work, but they may have seen Betty Boop and Popeye cartoons.
The Fleischer Studios had an interesting history that began in New York City and had roots in the ethnic humor of vaudeville traditions. As Dial notes, quote, Max Fleischer entered the new world of animation in 1915 as the inventor of the rotoscope, a machine that converted the movements of filmed actors into amazingly lifelike cartoon characters, end quote. Using the rotoscope to film the motions of his brother Dave, Fleischer created the character Coco the Clown and made the studio's reputation. In 1921, Fleischer Studios partnered with Paramount Pictures to distribute their cartoons, It was the same year Walt Disney launched his own animation company. The partnership changed in 1929 when Paramount gained control over 51% of the stock and copyrights to all the cartoons. The inequality of that agreement would play a role in the downfall of Fleischer Studios. Fleischer's focus on the kind of gritty, over-the-top humor with its sexual innuendo found less audience support by the late 1920s and the Depression years, as cartoons, quote, grew increasingly less gag-driven and more story-oriented, end quote. The audience for cartoons shifted as well from a novelty for adults to entertainment for children. The more artistic Disney cartoons and the 1934 production code forced Fleischer Studios to adapt. The risque Betty Boop, for instance, quote, exchanged her minuscule dress and garter for a more demure frock with a raised neckline and a lowered hem, end quote. As the Fleischers adapted to changing audiences and tastes, they also faced internal production problems. Max Fleischer viewed the company as one big happy family of 200 employees crammed into three floors of 1600 Broadway. But in 1937, his workers walked off the job to protest long hours and short pay. Other companies would face the same demands over the next 5 years, but Fleischer, as the first, was caught off guard. Max Fleischer saw the strike as an example of ingratitude and refused National Labor Relations Board arbitration. The strike ended in October 1937, but set in motion the move to Florida. Adding to their miseries, Disney released Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first full-length animated film in 1937. Paramount pressured Fleischer to create his own feature film, and they made preparations for, quote, a loose, very loose interpretation of Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, end quote. To complete this film meant doubling the staff and abandoning their New York facilities.
Connie, the changing cultural and labor landscape for animation led Fleischer Studios to abandon its historic association with New York to seek a new location. Why did they choose Miami, and what was Miami's response?
The choice of Miami seems to have been based on several factors. Max and Dave Fleischer already owned beach houses in Miami. Land was cheap, and Florida exempted relocating film companies from property taxes. Florida did not support unions, making an expansion of the workforce less fraught, and Miami began soliciting the animation company during the labor strike. That said, one observer noted, quote, Miami might as well have been in Tibet. Every foot of film had to be shipped to New York laboratories for development. Any breakdown of equipment would have to be serviced from the East. There were few experienced sound engineers in Florida, no actors, no labor pool of experienced artists, end quote. The Fleischers broke ground on the new animation studio March 1, 1938. Miami was delighted. The Miami Herald proclaimed, quote, Miami's dream of a motion picture industry at long last seems about to be realized. Miami wants and needs this new enterprise, end quote. The studio was placed on land being developed by John Ware Jr. in the northwest section of Dade County. Ware envisioned Fleischer Studios as the centerpiece of Delaware Park, an upscale housing development of concrete hurricane-proof homes surrounded by lush landscaping and natural limestone pools. But the transition to Miami was not smooth. New Yorkers found the still rural nature of Dade County and the climate a difficult adjustment. Coming from a city more tolerant of racial, ethnic, and religious differences, they were sometimes met with hostility, as when Max Fleischer received an intimidating note from the local Ku Klux Klan after hosting Cab Calloway for dinner at his home. The move was off to a rocky start and would get worse. Fleischer Studios brought 200 New Yorkers to work at the Miami facility and added 200 more from California. They successfully defeated a CIO attempt to unionize the studio, but did not receive the expected tax break. The brothers fell out with one another over an alleged extramarital affair between Dave and his secretary. Their Popeye cartoons continued to be very popular, but Gulliver's Travels, although opening to great fanfare in Miami, received mixed but overall positive reviews, not the raves that the Fleischers hoped would accompany the world's second feature-length cartoon. Meanwhile, Disney was hard at work on Pinocchio, and Paramount began pressuring Fleischer Studios for another film. The film was titled Mr. Bug Goes to Town. While Max Fleischer stressed the importance of the story as a community of insects, the film opened 3 days before Pearl Harbor to little fanfare and failed to recoup expenses. With debts to Paramount of $573,000 for its two feature films, Dave Fleischer resigned to work for Columbia Pictures, and Max took a position in Detroit producing Army training films. Paramount seized the property in May 1942. Dial concludes with a view of Miami as a city that serves as a site for filmmaking, not the film center once envisioned. Remnants of Delaware Park and the Delaware Parkway still exist as quirky houses and a four-lane roadway that runs past the old studio before disappearing at the Miami River.
Interesting as always. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
The Wonderful World of Disney.
This is Florida Frontiers. Michael V. Gannon was a respected Florida historian, educator, and author. Before he passed away in 2017, he shared some thoughts with us about the man who gave our state its name.
There are two things that most people think they know about Juan Ponce de Leon, or Ponce de Leon as we commonly say. The first is that in 1513 he was the first European voyager to discover Florida. The second is that he was hunting a fountain of youth. To the first notion, we can say that Spanish slaving ships probably encountered Florida before Juan Ponce did. To the second, we can say that the authorizing charter granted him by Spanish King Fernando II made no mention of a fountain of youth. Historians today think that fountain was really only a myth. What Juan Ponce stumbled upon was a huge peninsula, which he thought was an island. He gave it the name La Florida, the flowery land. And Florida is what we call it still today.
The late, great Florida historian Michael Gannon. Every year, the Florida Historical Society presents the Michael V. Gannon Lifetime Achievement Award at our Public History Forum. This year, the Public History Forum is being held May 16th through 18th in conjunction with the Tallahassee Historical Society Bicentennial Conference. Find out more at myfloridahistory.org. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for the program comes from Connie Lester. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.